This is Book Radio. I'm Mark Strassen. Our guest today is Donald Scotto, who's the author of Diana, The Last Year. Welcome to Book Radio.
Thank you very much.
Before writing this book, you've also written biographies of, among other people, Marilyn Monroe and James Dean. There's a song about James Dean that says, too fast to live, too young to die, bye-bye. Is there much in common between the people you've written about already and Princess Diana?
Well, they both had to endure this appalling burden of celebrity and fame, which to me is the great four-letter word of our time. Living within this relentless glare of publicity, and in fact defining themselves by default, if you will, through their relationship to people filtered through the press. So they all share in common this terrible burden of celebrity.
That's like the close to the crux of the whole story here. Is there a way out of that other than to stay away from it?
Well, I think one has to have extraordinary inner resources in order to cope with celebrity in our time. I, for example, have often been very grateful to be a writer since, with very few exceptions, we're not recognized in public.
Right.
And, you know, one could go to a restaurant or get on an airplane and only but rarely is one recognized. So you really have a certain level of privacy.
Right.
The problem with being a star, and Diana was every bit as much of a star as Madonna, is that you have in our time not only to cope with the constant attention, but also, if you are of a certain age, as indeed Diana was, very young, born in 1961, she grew up with the presumption that when you have a case to make, you make it to the public by summoning the cameras and the microphones. If in addition to that, you have a blighted past, as she did, a broken home, an unhappy marriage, your self-esteem, one of the overused cliches of our time, there it is, your self-esteem is buoyed and bolstered and established and sustained only by this constant feedback that you require from the anonymous masses.
You have to get that fix, essentially, because
well, some do.
Diana, Princess of Wales, who's the subject of Diana the Last Year, there seems to be several Dianas in the book who I've essentially categorized as the Sister of Mercy, the Fashion Plate, and the Immature Girl. Would you say that sort of that those are three different women living within the same person?
I think you're spot on correct, as the British would say.
Right. Tell us a little about each of them
well,
and their relationship.
As a matter of fact, let's begin with the understanding that we all of us carry aspects of complex characters and personalities within ourselves.
Right.
In the case of Diana, certainly, here was a woman who loved beautiful clothes and the glamorous life. She was a child of her generation. And she grew up, you know, as a country gentlewoman in a life of privilege and vast manor houses and consorting with the royal family and this sort of thing. And then from the age of 20, the most photographed, celebrated, glamorous woman in the world. So that was taken for granted.
Right.
She was also there was yes, a tendency to immaturity, which you mentioned last. That is to say, when she died, she was 36 going on 20. But how could it be otherwise? Although she held down a job briefly as a nursery school nanny, the fact is she never had to have a job in her life.
Right.
There was a limited responsibility. Only late in her life did she become, as you said in the first designation, the Sister of Mercy. So while one elegantly shod foot was in the camp of Gianni Versace and designer fashion shows and the rest, the other simply clad foot was in the camp of Mother Teresa.
Well,
this was very important.
In fact, on the two covers of your book, she's shown on the front cover in a Red Cross outfit, and on the back in a, I don't know whose it was, it could have been a Versace outfit, fresh from a ball or at a ball and so on. And you talk about days in which she essentially goes from the ball to the hospital
yes.
Ward.
Yes. Was she self-conscious about the paradox of this particular arrangement?
I think, instead of saying it as a paradox, I think she was really a bridge between these two worlds. There is, of course, only to the most appalling kind of Puritan mentality. There's nothing wrong with enjoying a glamorous life as long as one doesn't require of it more than it has to offer, namely serenity and a spiritual home base and any kind of ultimate significance in life. If it is a diversion, and if one can use that glamorous limelight and one's influence for good, as indeed she was doing in the last part of her life, then that's just fine.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the procedure through which this book was written. Were you already working on a piece? Or your last book was about the Windsors in general.
2 years ago, as you rightly point out, I published a book called The Decline and Fall of the House of Windsor, and while researching and writing that over many years, it appeared to me that the pivotal person in the shifting fortunes and destiny of the royal family was indeed Diana Spencer Windsor. So what I have been doing over the years was to stockpile a massive amount of material, archival information, interviews, etc. When she died so suddenly, the book simply took a different shape and a different focus. But it was not the work of a few days.
How much access did you have to her previous to her?
Well, I had no access to her personally at all.
Right.
I was fortunate enough, however, to enjoy spectacular access to people who knew her and to archives and to documents that really illuminated the story for me in a very profound way.
The issue of the House of Windsor itself and her place in it then and her effect, her effect on it and the effect of her death on it is obviously an important one. You rightly call them, or you mentioned that they had a name before. They were the Windsors during World War One.
Yes.
They were the Saxe Coburg Gothas.
Yes,
apparently
the family name, of course, came from Prince Albert, the consort of Queen Victoria, who was German, even more German than Queen Victoria. So the line passing down in the 19th century from Victoria to her descendants is Saxe Coburg Gotha. Now, during World War One, it was considered quite inadvisable for the King of England to have German names, since
right.
They were active enemies.
Even though they were family with the Kaiser.
There you are, family with the Kaiser indeed, and cousins to the Tsar and all that.
Right.
And Lord Stamfordham, who was the King's most important advisor, simply decided, well, let's choose the name of the castle that is the most ancient and venerable in the realm.
Right.
So they took the name Windsor.
But it's a particular issue for the family that's the ruling family, and I'd like to sort of talk about that. Diana is often cited and discussed in your book as the people's princess and so on, as the bridge between royalty and the common people. And I would like to focus a little bit on, I guess, your attitudes about the possibility of doing that, about whether it's possible to bridge that gap, or whether or not the monarchy as such, because Diana always said, you say Diana always said, she wanted to preserve the monarchy for her children and so on and so forth, but isn't it a living contradiction of democracy to have a royal family by birth?
I think not, and I think the element that demonstrates the truth of this is if we look at the crowned heads of Europe. If we look at the royal families of Spain, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Belgium, Holland, Luxembourg, etc.,
right.
What we see is a family that represents the fact that a nation has a tradition, but above and beyond and outlasting and outliving any politician or political party, a nation is made up of families. A representative family, which passes down its heritage from one generation to the next, simply stands for that. Now, the success of these crowned heads in the other countries is they hold down jobs, they go to school, they ride streetcars, they're very much loved and accepted by their people because they do not regard themselves, as does the royal family of England, with mystic aura about them. The courtiers of England have always said, with curled lip and great contempt, have always said, we shall never be a bicycle monarchy. In other words, we shan't live the way the crowned heads of the continent live, which is riding bicycles in the streets.
Do you feel they should? That they should become a bicycle monarchy?
Well, should or shouldn't is I hasten to say at first, hardly up to an American historian or biographer.
Right.
It's really up to the British people.
Do you think the British people have demanded a non-bicycle monarchy, and the tourism board has demanded a non-bicycle?
It isn't so much tourism. It's, I think, that the essential conservatism of the British people,
right,
and coupled with the fact that we have this radical decline of the empire, you know,
right,
the sun never setting,
yes,
on the British Empire.
That's all
ancient history.
That's
now.
All the time now.
The only thing that differentiates Britain in a pop culture,
right,
is a different representative family. Now, I hasten to add that there are few people more Anglophilic than myself.
Right.
I mean, England has given us the greatest literature in the history of the world, the richest language, the most magnificent music and art. I mean, there, you know, this is,
right,
a great culture despite its smallness.
Right. Is it possible then that the issue of the monarchy sounds, from the way you're saying it, to be of a par with the euro and with British integration into Europe? In other words, in order to stand apart as an island, the envy of less happy realms, the British need these distinguishing characteristics, that is to say, their own currency, their own government, and their own royal family that travels by horse-drawn coach and not by bike. Is it part of that issue, do you think?
I think it's very much part of it.
Okay.
I really do. And I think that, you know, this hanging on to a form of the tradition rather than a deeper adherence to the meaning of the tradition is very dangerous, because what you wind up with is you have a royal family who may not hold down jobs, whom you disallow any kind of public voice or responsibility, and then you're shocked when all they do is drink and have affairs.
Right.
What are they supposed to do?
Right. So that the dysfunction in the family is in fact a direct consequence of the particular structure that the family has to live in.
Precisely.
Okay. Let's talk a little about Diana and her troubles she's had with relationships. Essentially, she had none with men before she was married. And she then had the good fortune, or I use the term facetiously, to be married to, well, how would you characterize Prince Charles when it comes to having relationships with women in general and with Diana in particular?
Well, I think we have to backtrack for a moment and say that we have to keep in mind that the marriage between Diana Spencer and the Prince of Wales was completely arranged.
Right.
And it is the key element in the Cinderella fairy tale,
right,
because she fulfills every aspect of the Cinderella fairy tale. Broken home, wicked stepmother, two rival older sisters, and along comes a fairy godmother in the joint person of her grandmother, Lady Fermoy, and the Queen Mother of England, who say, we will take of this poor benighted little girl, and we will make her into the princess. Off she goes to the ball, meets the handsome prince. It's all arranged.
Including the search throughout the kingdom for the princess.
There you are. There you are. Exactly.
Right.
And here is the virginal, wonderful, desirable candidate who, alas, finds out all too quickly that, you know, the coach is really a rotting pumpkin, and the slipper, if you put your foot into it, is bound to be smashed.
And when she kisses the prince, he turns into a frog.
Well, I think it's possible, you know, with the glamour and beauty and attractiveness of Diana.
Right.
It's possible to be far too hard on Prince Charles than he deserves.
Okay.
And many people have been, and I do think it's terribly unfair. My impression, and I think the record will sustain this, my impression about the Prince of Wales is that he is a decent, thoughtful, sensitive man ever since childhood. And talk about growing up in a dysfunctional and non-functional family, it's amazing that he's not a complete wastrel or an alcoholic or a drug addict. There are, after all, precedents in the royal family for the Prince of Wales becoming just so.
Right.
I think he's done remarkably well.
Given the circumstances.
Given the circumstances.
Okay. In any event, the marriage was hindered from the beginning by his ongoing relationship with Camilla Parker Bowles.
That is correct. And there lies a crux. After all, the Prince of Wales comes from a tradition in which this is what the members of the royal family, what the men do. He took a cue from his own father,
right,
who has evidently, cut a wide path across the thresholds of the women of the world. So he marries Diana, he does his duty, he sires two sons, and his true love, hardly a one-night stand, hardly a cheap affair,
right,
is a woman with whom he's bonded very deeply and continues to do so. What he and the court and the palace do not take into account is that in selecting this young, vital child of the 60s, Diana Spencer, she has rather more romantic expectations in our time, which is very odd, isn't it? Because we think of ourselves as being a cynical age. The fact is, we buy totally into the fairy tale myth of the happy ending, and no one bought it, lock, stock, and barrel, more than Diana Spencer.
You said it was an arranged marriage. Didn't the people who were arranging it have some sense of what kind of person Prince Charles was? If not a lot of information about Diana, and therefore might have projected that it wasn't going to work, unless, of course, they were so infatuated with the very idea themselves of the fairy tale scenario without any thought to real human psychology on the part of the two people who are going to have to act it out.
Well, real human psychology, as you rightly imply, real human psychology simply doesn't enter into it when you've got an image and a role to fulfill for a 33-year-old heir to the throne. Psychology and the future be damned. We need a wedding.
Right. Okay. Well, and they got one.
And everything else.
Okay.
And everything else.
As the marriage of the Waleses became irretrievably broken, Diana apparently took up with several similar inappropriate men, as you
well, in this, of course, she's not alone.
No,
in the world.
Of course not. No.
Many people choose intimates, unfortunately or ill-advisedly, but they don't do so deliberately.
Right.
What's a woman to do? Her husband is giving and receiving intimate comforts elsewhere. What is she to do? She's a healthy, lovely young woman who delights in male companions.
And she could hardly have advertised in the local papers.
Well, she could hardly have taken an ad in a personal column.
Right.
You know.
All right. Well, so skipping ahead to after they were divorced, she then finds herself being invited by Mohammed Al-Fayed to his compound in the south of France. What was in that for him?
Well, it's really very simple. After all, there's a long history of the Fayeds and the Spencers. Mohammed Al-Fayed was a great friend of Diana's father, who was not so long ago deceased. And he, Mohammed Al-Fayed, is also a man who has been treated rather shabbily by the British establishment.
Right.
Although he owns the jewel in the diadem, if you will,
right,
of British economy, namely Harrods,
right,
and brings an enormous amount to bear on the British economy, he has been denied citizenship, and there were some rather shady business dealings as well.
Can you say any more, as much as you want to, mm-hmm, about how shady and what dealings these were? He is the brother-in-law of
Adnan Khashoggi, the arms dealer.
Right.
So the whole thing has a certain hint and tincture, if you will, of you can sort of understand why the British establishment is not eager to play footsie with the Fayed family.
Right.
I totally reject the fact that it has anything to do with his race or his religious background. I resent this. I think this is not true.
You think that's beneath the British establishment?
I think it is beneath them in terms of how they act. How individuals feel is one thing. But no country in the world is more of a melting pot in the last of the 20th century than Britain itself. And I think that to fix on Mr. Fayed's race and religion.
It was the reason why he rejected. It was their perception of the sleaziness of his business deals.
That's exactly.
Kept him out.
So he invites her and her sons to come for a holiday. Now, onto the scene comes his son.
Yes, and enter the Dark Prince.
Enter Dodi Al-Fayed. Now, I say this a little facetiously, but not entirely. How seriously can we take a 42-year-old man who calls himself Dodi? I mean, now, what I mean by that is sort of the carrier of something facetious, but also I'm very serious. Here is a man, talk about no responsibility. He has never held a job. He has never had to hold down a job. Being a nominal movie producer was simply an avenue and an excuse to lead the high life in Southern California,
right,
to be able to have access to squire around actresses and models.
Right.
Mind you, I am not scolding or proclaiming him to be some kind of immoral roustabout.
Right.
I'm simply assessing the evidence that this man really didn't do very much with his life.
In fact, though, what you've the way you've characterized him is remarkably similar to the way to the Prince of Wales. Never held a job. Prince. He is essentially a prince of his own. His father is not wealthy on the level of the Windsors, but and he has in fact become in some ways the dissolute prince option that you were just describing. Charles is having avoided, but or accept or reject or partially
that
analysis.
I think that comparing Prince Charles to Dodi Al-Fayed, Prince Charles comes off almost looking like Thomas More.
Oh, of course,
that
he
is to say,
well,
he was a man. Prince Charles is a man with concerns, with concerns about his country, its economy, its people,
its architecture.
I mean, he's not a stupid and foolish and insensitive person. I don't think we have a great deal of evidence for claiming for Dodi Al-Fayed any greater concern than, where's the next party?
Wine, women, and I don't know about song.
I don't know about song either. But
wine. Okay. So
along he comes.
Right.
And lavishes the most extraordinary attention on Diana. Now, we must admit straight away that people who try to say, how could she possibly fall for him, fail to take into account that when chemistry rules the day, nobody can understand the equation here except the principles involved.
Based on what you said, it's hard to see how she couldn't, how she could resist him, how she couldn't become involved with him, because as it seems, I don't want to, if I make this this analysis too extreme, let me know. But it seems to me that the Fayed family had every reason psychologically. The only thing they lacked in life was sticking it to the British establishment. And what better way to do this than to spirit away the lovely blonde princess of the realm. And they had and Dodi was absolutely as though he had been trained from birth to do that job with his looks and his money and his experience and his talent in doing that. And Diana, for her part, it's a little ambiguous in your treatment, but there was no love lost, it seems to me, between her and the top, between the queen and so on.
Well, no love lost certainly between Diana and the court and the courtiers, but we have to keep something in mind here. It's very tempting, and I think incorrect, to see Diana as a rebel longing to thumb her nose at the British royal family.
Right.
After all, her son is the future king.
Right, you make that point over and over again, that she wasn't trying to do
and
that.
And I think, by the way, that's one of the reasons, and we can discuss this in considerable detail, that's one of the reasons why she never in the world would have married Dodi Al-Fayed.
No, I never thought she would.
Not at all.
All right, but in fact, at some level, since her quest for self-development that you chronicle fundamentally involved becoming her own person and establishing her own right to do what the gray man and the queen had prevented her from doing, what stronger thing could she do than become the girlfriend of the biggest irritant to the stability of the British equanimity of
I agree with you.
So given that dynamic, then they were essentially drawn together like magnets, and had this short relationship.
Yes.
And I want to talk a little bit about that. I think you make this point, and it became clear to me, perhaps just out of what you had said, that had they been in love, had their primary interest been in each other as potential partners, present partners, they would have gone to one of the many retreats to which each of their wealth entitled them, and sat there in the wherever it was, whichever room of the house they had chosen, whichever rooms, and been together and talked and experienced each other and enjoyed each other's company, rather than flaunting their relationship in front of the press over and over again. In fact, that's what it seems they spent most of their time together doing. How do you like that?
Well, I think you're quite right, but I think what we have to see here is this is all Dodi.
Okay.
This is a man who needs to show the world that on his arm and in his presence is the Princess of Wales.
Right.
This is his supreme value. When I chronicle the final days of Dodi and Diana, it seems as if the story could end no other way. My impression in reading about people who are having this incredibly passionate affair is that most people want to draw the draperies, lock the door after ordering room service, and simply be alone together. He didn't do that. I mean, look at the last several days. They are flitting about, flying about from one venue to the next. He's not acting like a passionate man who wants to be alone with his beloved.
Right.
He's acting like a man who is lining up the press, who is saying, now where's the next group? Now where can we station them here? Let's go to Paris. We go to Paris, we go to the Villa Windsor. Then we go to his apartment. Then we go to the Ritz Hotel. Then we go back to his apartment. Then we think, oh, well, let's go to Chez Benoit for dinner. Well, Chez Benoit has too many paparazzi and too many people dining in close quarters. Let's go back to the hotel. I mean, then they get back to the hotel and they say, well, let's instead go back to my apartment. But what is going on here?
Right. Many of the paparazzi from Paris were interviewed on 2020 on last Friday, the 21st, and one of them said they were there to make it official that they were a couple. They said the paparazzi said that's why they were in Paris.
Well, you know,
that a little strong, you think?
It's a little strong.
Okay.
I mean, I feel that Diana, of course, did not. Diana was a girl who, like a little bit like a Do Annie, when she met a man that she was willing to throw in her fortunes with, however briefly,
right.
She was a girl who couldn't say no. And here she was on her own steam. She would have said, "I don't want to go out again. We've just been out." But she's willing to cede her decision-making prowess and powers to this man who's, you know, taking control.
Right. That's exactly what it occurs to me. And that was her mistake of giving up the struggle that you chronicle to be her own person and saying, I'm in love, I'm infatuated, I'm in lust, whatever it was she was with him, and saying, do with me as you will, Dodie.
Yeah.
And that was what she had been trying to learn not to do from her whole experience.
It's very sad.
Yes,
it's very difficult when you're trying to be a person in love who wants to please.
Right.
And pleasing was enormously important to Diana.
Well, it was a lesson she didn't learn well enough, it seems.
Well, you know, I find her a very sympathetic creature.
Okay.
It is astonishing to me. It is remarkable that this girl, trained to nothing except the pursuit of fun as if it were a religious vocation, that she really developed the authentic and profound human concerns that her own blighted childhood, her disappointing marriage, her eating disorders, that all the liabilities and sorrows and challenges of her life did not make her withdrawn and isolated and bittered and removed from people. It broke open her heart and her spirit and enabled her to reach out, just as the great character of Queen Dido says in Virgil's Aeneid, you know, I am no stranger to misfortune myself. Therefore, I've learned how to extend a helping hand to the needy. And Diana did this, and did it with great feeling. When she appeared in all of these places without gloves, it was a potent symbol. Royalty, aristocracy, never allow skin to touch skin in public. You never shake hands with a stranger. Diana went into hospitals and leprosaria and AIDS wards and embraced people wearing no gloves. Months before she died, as we know, she auctioned off this extravagant and extraordinary wardrobe, and the proceeds went to her charities. She was streamlining her life. She was a woman who was coming to the point at which she was able to say, I want more significance and less silliness.
Do you think that's the reason as many people mourned her as did? Is it that simple or is it more complicated?
I think that the real reason for what has now come to be called the newest cliche, massive outpouring of grief,
right?
I think the real reason for this is twofold. First of all, I think people are weeping for themselves.
In what sense?
It's in the sense of Jared Manley Hopkins' great poem, Spring and Fall. You know, it is the blight man was born for. It is Margaret you mourn for, he says to the little girl who doesn't, named Margaret, who doesn't know why she's weeping. And I mean precisely this. We look at Diana, beautiful, loved, adored, admired, celebrated, rich, healthy. She can have anything and anyone in the world, and in a nanosecond, everything is removed and she's dead. If it can happen to Diana, who seems to be a stained glass window figure beyond any kind of wickedness or evil or accident, what we're grieving for is the fact of our own fragility, our vulnerability, that life is short, that we'd better attend to who and what we really are. We're grieving for the loss of our own improper dreams.
Yeah, that certainly makes sense to me. And the other you're saying that.
And I think also the loss, and this is a secondary sequela, if you will, it's the loss of the fairy tale. You know, you still have people talking about it's so tragic because she had met the true love of her life. And I say, oh, why are we willing to impose on Dodi Al-Fayed what we saw didn't work even after 15 years with Charles?
Right.
What is this happy ever after nonsense? You know, we simply have to.
Well, what is that happy ever after nonsense? Why is that such a strong force in human affairs?
Because we usually muck these things up. We usually muddle them. And I think deeply rooted in the core of our nature is the longing for something or someone absolutely stable.
So you're saying people are disappointed that that Diana's fairy tale didn't...
dreadfully disappointed.
But correct me if I'm wrong, it's my understanding that the fairy tales all end and they lived happily ever after, but we never hear about how they lived happily ever after. And the joke, the irony, the parody source is often what happens to them after they lived happily ever after, and they often, as in this case, didn't.
Yes, well, this, of course, is why, and I say this with great gravity and respect, this is why the great love stories in history always end tragically.
Right.
You know, Baudelaire, Dr. Baudelaire wanted the ending of Romeo and Juliet to be that they're revived in the tomb, push the stone back, and live happily ever after. Now, what do? Go off to Verona and open a Gucci franchise?
Right.
I mean, exactly what can happen to such perfect love as Romeo and Juliet? Death is the perfect finale. And under the root of all this, I think it's very important to keep this in mind. Remember that the fairy tales were codified in 17th, 18th century France by Père Perrault. The fairy tales were codified within the Kleeglites of a profound Judeo-Christian faith. And the tragic vision, the vision of earthly happiness that ends in death, is a vision that suggests and implies that permanent, lasting happiness is not of this world.
And in fact,
it's achieved in the beyond.
And you can see people can learn about the run-up to that moment in Diana the Last Year by Donald Spoto. Thanks for talking to us about it. It's been a pleasure. Many thanks.